Hi, I'm Jeff Rank, the editorial director of Manufacturing.net and Manufacturing Business Technology. Welcome to Security Breach. Today, we're going to address an ongoing challenge within the industrial cybersecurity sector, but with insight from one of the most highly decorated guests we've ever had on Security Breach. And the timing couldn't be better. The MIT Technology Review Insights recently reported that mid-sized companies, which would mean manufacturing enterprises with annual revenues of between $2 and $700 million, were almost 500% more likely to be targeted now than just 2 years ago. Similarly, Fortinet has released findings indicating that 93% of manufacturers have had to respond to at least one intrusion targeting operational technologies within the last 12 months, and 78% have experienced multiple attacks. I know you've heard these types of stats before. At the risk of becoming white noise, we'll continue to share these findings. Remember, if U.S. manufacturing were its own country, it would have the eighth largest GDP in the world. And the lifeblood of this sector is the small and mid-sized manufacturer. Keeping these businesses running without operational disruption, intellectual property theft, or employee data theft, and in as secure a manner as possible, has never been more important as we continue to struggle with inflation, logistics challenges, and supply chain disruptions. Joining us to discuss this situation is Jeff Engel, Chairman and President of Conquest Cyber, a leader in industrial cybersecurity solutions and services. So, Jeff, you have kind of a unique background, and I'm not sure how much of it you can talk about, but being a former Special Forces team leader, you also spent time with the DoD's Defense Threat Reduction Agency. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how some of those experiences have formed your path into cybersecurity and some of your opinions and attitudes about it as a career path.
No, absolutely. I would first like to clarify that in the Army, Special Forces is a job, and then Special Operations is a larger category. So I spent my formative years in a Special Operations organization, where my job was a little bit broader than Special Forces, and I think that tied in with the subsequent roles that I had within the Department of Defense, as well as things that led me to that point. Really, the what's informed those formative years and ultimately what I've done since then is a level of mission focus that I think is unique, particularly to those organizations where there is nobody to call in the event that something goes wrong. It increases the level of attention to detail. It forms a tighter bond because the people that are around you are really the only ones that can help. And that mission focus and the team mentality and the significance of success or failure, I think I've brought with me in the roles that I've had, since my early 20s when I got to do those unique roles. And it's definitely informed how I've built this organization and this business, and how we've tried to use mission to really shape everything from the way we select our team members to the way we support our customers and the way that we make decisions up and down the ranks of the organization.
No, it makes a lot of sense. So borrowing a military term, we talked about situational readiness right now. If you looked at the U.S. manufacturing sector, there's an awareness or an appreciation of cybersecurity due to some of the attacks that have gotten bigger headlines. But when you look at some of the small and medium-sized enterprises, there's sort of a prevailing thought of this doesn't really relate to us. We're not really on the target screen. We're not really a big target for a lot of these hackers. How would you respond to that? And I guess depending on how you feel about that, how do we get folks to move past that a little bit and realize they are susceptible to attacks and people do care about them?
Yeah. Well, every opportunity I'm given to advocate for a shift in mindset, I do. I think with we had a geographical advantage for almost all of our time as being a superpower, where we have massive oceans on our east and west coast, and we have friendly countries to our north and south. So that geographic position, in the United States, has really given us a competitive edge, along with the diversity that you have from coast to coast. With the adoption of additional technologies and globalization and global connectivity, we've really lost that advantage when it comes to the domain of cyberspace. So whenever anybody within any sector, critical infrastructure sectors in particular, which manufacturing is a part of, doesn't understand that the front line is on their front, you know, their front doorstep. I give a series of examples of where manufacturing has been a critical support for our national defense strategy, and why the smaller and mid-market manufacturers, along with all of the other critical functions that kind of meet that category, are actually the most heavily targeted parts of our critical infrastructure sectors. So the small budgets, focus on generating margin and hitting bottom line targets, making manufacturing more streamlines through technology. All that does is increases the attack surface, and our adversaries are not exclusively focused on the big names that everyone recognizes, but the significant support infrastructure that's provided by small and mid-market manufacturers to really all aspects of society. And from an adversary perspective, that's where I would go, because they have access to the same information. They've got largely access to some of the primes and name suppliers, and they do niche services, which without them, ultimately it has ripple effects across American society and our national defense strategy. So if you could find me a manufacturer that doesn't in some way, shape, or form support our way of life, which ultimately makes them a target, you'd be educating me, because I haven't run against one yet.
No, absolutely. Another military term, it's a target-rich environment for the bad guys out there in terms of the manufacturing sector, regardless of size or product that's going out the door. So when you look at some of the vulnerabilities then that are out there, what are some of the areas that you're seeing exploited to the most frequently? Are there certain areas where manufacturers really need to be aware of they're being targeted in this general area?
Yeah, I would say that really you look across the hundreds of thousands of organizations that make up some elements in manufacturing, the amount of resources that are being put towards their individual cyber defense and then their larger collective defense is not on par with what the adversaries are putting towards attacking them. So the vulnerability kind of at the highest strategic level is just lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, lack of focus on protecting, detecting, and responding effectively to the level of adversaries that that ultimately are coming after them. But when you get into the nuts and bolts of it, manufacturers deal with a lot of operational technologies. And one of the biggest problems I see when it comes to the mission components of cybersecurity, cyber resiliency, is that the segmentation between information technology, which has a significant footprint and a lot of it's cloud-based and a lot of it's rapidly targeted by adversaries, and the operational technologies that are supporting those critical manufacturing processes, those being on the same network creates a lot of problems, because the way that they operate, the way they're maintained, the way they're supported is all very different. But beyond that, I would say that the next biggest concern is really around the introduction of third-party risk. So as particularly a small or mid-market manufacturer, but it's true of all, and goes far beyond that sector, is the reliance for critical services, which gives access to your data and ultimately determines whether or not they can provide their goods and services out to the markets they support. There's just not a lot of good visibility and oversight into those third parties. So really you're inheriting whatever vulnerabilities that those other parties have. And they too are in this position that they don't really, in aggregate, put enough resources, experience, capabilities, into into providing cyber resiliency for those things they support that ultimately support manufacturers who then, you know, support either larger manufacturers or the consumers, you know, governments, whoever it may be, that are the beneficiaries of that specific organization's manufacturing processes. So big problems with third-party risk, big problems with network segmentation, but ultimately the first thing that's the issue is the top-level leadership, the boards, the C-suite, understanding that that regardless of whether or not your name is on a stadium somewhere, you are a target. And you're not just a target by, you know, an 18-year-old in his basement. You're a target by some of the most sophisticated adversaries that exist on the planet, you know, these advanced persistent threats. We've seen that, you know, disrupting supply chain can ultimately cripple elements of the U.S. economy. And if you were to do that at scale, which they've developed capabilities to do, it gives them a competitive edge.
I want to circle back to some of those adversaries that are out there and how much more complex they're becoming. But you mentioned a lot of different things there. And we've talked on this show about all the different connective points with Industry 4.0 technologies. We've talked about the API calls that are out there, the edge, the cloud, all these different areas that are storing and accessing data. If you're a small to medium-sized manufacturer, or really any manufacturer, where do you start in putting together your cyber defense plan?
Yeah. I always advise that when you've got limited resources, you have to understand where you're putting them first. And that comes through a risk analysis. And I'm not talking about some complex, you know, quantitative formulas where you have to isolate every point of data. I'm talking about just a, you know, back of the napkin. If I was sitting around a CEO group with my peers, what would they say I was incompetent if I did not understand to be a potential scenario I might face? So things like ransomware, scenarios that you're provided by your cyber insurer, you know, industry publications provide some examples of things that have happened to other, you know, similar organizations. Just taking that and understanding some scenarios that you should be designing your program around is an incredibly critical first step. And then everything else you need exists. That's the one thing that's kind of unique to your organization is understanding, you know, or your vertical, how you do your business, what you do, how that potentially might get targeted by an adversary. And then you've got all of the resources available, the NIST cybersecurity framework. You've got regulatory requirements that may provide an overlay to that. Like if you're a manufacturer that provides something to the Department of Defense or a tier one DOD industrial base prime contractor, you've got that NIST 800-171 overlay. You've got DFARS clauses you may have to hit. So when you take the combined compliance requirements, which are generally based off of broad realization of risk, and you take the kind of the NIST cybersecurity framework overlay of identifying what's important, you know, assessing the risk to it, putting the protective measures in place, detection, response, recovery, all that, it doesn't have to be 500 pages worth of policy. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, millions of dollars worth of technology. If you have a general sense of what you do, how you do it, why a bad guy might target it, and you put some things in place, then you're in a better spot than most organizations are. The fact that you're just a little bit of focus will get, you know, it would have a significant impact.
Absolutely. Circling back to some of those adversaries, is there anything you're seeing now in terms of either new groups emerging or new tactics coming forward? In manufacturing, you know, ransomware gets a lot of headlines with JBS, with Colonial Pipeline, things like that have happened in the past, and there are others as well. Is there anything new that's sort of popping up on your radar screen, either as a group or, again, as some of the new tactics that are being used?
So, you know, groups like to change the name to protect the guilty. The adversaries that are out there are largely pretty well established, particularly the ones that I concern myself with the most. And those are the nation state level advanced persistent threats, which creates a little bit of cognitive dissonance, right? The things that you hear about in the news are largely because they took actions on the objective. They actually executed that ransomware and tried to get funding. the ones that are more concerning to me use the same processes, the same ability to access those environments, and they build a persistent presence over time to where they could take that action. And it's essentially the same thing, whether you actually ask for a ransom or you just encrypt the system and prevent them from being able to access it. I'm much more concerned with those nation state advanced level, advanced persistent threats or their proxies who do ransomware on the side to fund their activities, but are gaining access, persistent access into all different sectors, sometimes collecting data and sometimes just having the ability to take those systems down when it is in their geopolitical interests to do so. Now, and I have, some working theories around, Colonial Pipeline and the timing of that and how that ties back to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But if, I think of most things in terms of how I would do it. And if I'm a bad actor, I'm not going to, use my entire arsenal just because I can. I'm going to have the ability to impact many more organizations and many more sectors than I do. And I'm going to test in less consequential, organizations from a geopolitical standpoint, taking those actions. And then in the event that I wanted to do something and let's say prevent a response, I might take down a Colonial Pipeline as more of a warning shot, not to intervene in actions that may be taken, overseas against, neighbors or groups within your country. And I think we've seen that with, China and Russia specifically, where the invasion of Ukraine and some actions that we might not agree with within some of our other kind of near peers. Cyber has definitely been something that's held us back from being more proactive in our interventions. And I think that's recognized and that's likely to persist and increase as more of the global economy gets, technically connected.
So are the good guys losing this battle right now? Is that kind of where we're at?
Yes. So I guess my evoked response is that we're losing. I think the more thoughtful response is that we don't realize we're fighting. And that's the problem. How long did hostile activities happen before Pearl Harbor? It was Pearl Harbor that got us involved.
Yeah.
But we could have easily seen, hey, our friends and allies are being impacted. It's getting really close to home. We could do more. But Pearl Harbor generated a collective emotional response, which ultimately tied in activating aspects of the economy that we never really had. It had people going into the workforce and supporting manufacturing processes. It had companies changing their assembly lines. It really had, it created a movement, a collective response. And the unfortunate aspect of cyber is we have the ability to do far more than we do, but we are not collectively responding in a way that allows us to regain our competitive advantage. If we were to mobilize in the ways that we have in the past, there's no question that we would be winning in this conflict. But you can't win if you don't fight. And right now, we're not even really defending very effectively, let alone getting more proactive with the mobilization and the collective defense that's needed in order for us to gain the competitive advantage and let our governments, our federal governments and DOD and all others focus externally, because we don't have to worry about our ability to protect ourselves internally. Right now, we definitely do. So a lot of energy and a lot of focus and a lot of money is going into the federal government augmenting the lack of defense within the critical infrastructure sectors across the U.S.
So do you think more transparency could be part of the solution with that? I mean, we had the SACA passed earlier this year, but that's really only for those critical industries that the government has selected as part of the infrastructure or national defense. Still leaves a lot of manufacturers not included in that. If those individuals had to be more transparent and share more information about their attacks, do you think that could help with the collective sort of coming together a little bit?
I have not found the response to more regulation to actually align with the expected outcome. I guess is the way I would put it. We have some illustrative examples. The government requires NIST 800-171s, 110 controls. And up until there was the threat of somebody coming and checking, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of organizations just said, yes, absolutely. We meet all of those requirements. So when it comes to the implementation regulations and frameworks with no threat of accountability and impact, you're going to see a small subset of organizations that do the right thing, and everybody else is going to continue business as usual until they get fined. And then they'll determine the cost of the fine in relation to the cost of avoiding it.
Yeah.
And many of them will still choose to risk it. When it comes to transparency first requires you to have visibility. And unfortunately, if you don't know, you don't have to tell anybody. And sometimes that results in people sticking their head in the sand and not looking or not effectively monitoring and not identifying that there's a real event. So I think we're moving from a legislative and a regulatory standpoint to a position where you can't avoid in a position of leadership across these sectors. At least having a conversation around cyber, I think that's probably the most significant impact. But if there isn't a translation from fiduciary responsibility to moral obligation, they're going to do the absolute minimum, and they're going to hire lobbyists to make that minimum as inconsequentially impactful from their business standpoint as possible, rather than coming from the perspective of how do we generate the best collective defense, not just for me, but for my competitors within the sectors and our supply chain, both upstream and downstream from that organization.
So from where you're standing, if regulation isn't the key, enforcement maybe isn't even the key because we can't do it effectively, what is it going to take? Is it going to take the equivalent of a Pearl Harbor type of attack in order for people to get collectively on the same page?
I think it would take more than a Pearl Harbor style of attack at this point. Because the gap between the general consumer and the business leader, and the gap between the business leader and the cybersecurity professional, those gaps are too significant. It's still very much it's not my problem. And cyber, when we have cyber failures, there's always somebody to blame, right? The CISO gets fired. Right? The government should have caught that. The cyber insurer, starts to intervene. But we are really far away from it impacting emotionally the general member of the populace when there is a significant cyber event. And unfortunately, I think it would require one of our critical sectors to lose the faith and confidence of the general populace as a result of a cyber incident before we were able to generate more of a collective response. So let's say the financial services industry, adversaries were able to gain access, and we had hundreds of thousands of people within the US have the values in their retirement accounts changed. That might be enough as a result of the loss of faith and confidence in the financial system to generate a collective response. But the impacts would be so broad it would, because we are such a credit based system, that our way of life probably would never recover in the same way. So I think all of these pieces and parts are critical steps. And my hope is that we will start to have enough people educated in this, kind of in these last couple of generations, where technology is so critical to our individual way of life, not just from a functioning of the services we provide, but in the way that we operate, that it'll start to be a competitive differentiator for businesses and organizations, that if they have provable capabilities against the most advanced adversaries, and our government can start focusing on, externalizing some of that to be more of a deterrent rather than focusing on just providing, just-in-time support to these sectors after they've been attacked.
Yeah. So right now, are you seeing some companies understanding and knowledge of cybersecurity and their unwillingness to share some of that information because they see it as a competitive advantage within their sector?
Yeah. So from a cybersecurity industry standpoint, I think we have a number of factors within the industry that are driving some bad behaviors. Everything from private equity and VC funding and how that ends up driving organizations to focus on a niche rather than a more complete solution. But I think from a cyber industry perspective, it's impacting. I think we're starting to see some organizations at the top level, the largest enterprises, use security as a competitive differentiator. But I haven't seen that really translate into the bulk of enterprises in the manufacturing sector or many of the other critical infrastructure sectors, because their upstream and downstream ecosystem is essentially looking for cost savings, particularly with the way the economy is going. And cyber is largely seen as a cost center, something that drives down, net income and EBITDA rather than something that adds that value back. So until you can start charging a premium for provable, cyber resiliency within the ecosystem, you're going to see just enough to get by as more of the status quo rather than more advanced capabilities being built and advertised to really impact the organization's specific business operations.
Interesting. So you're not seeing a company like JBS saying, hey, we figured out how to stop this ransomware attack. We're not going to share that because that way this attack might be successful on Tyson, for example. It's not evolved to that level yet, or has it?
No. I don't think most organizations have, a nefarious intent, or if they thought that they could do some, provide some information or what have you that would ultimately benefit the sector, even if it's competitors, that they would really hold that back. And I think the reason that's not getting shared is more because when things happen, if it doesn't make it to the news, they don't want to say it. So, there's still going to be a negative impact on your business in the aftermath of a breach. And if you were to self-report and provide that information to a competitor, that maybe not public knowledge, that's still, largely going to be seen as too high of risk to most business leaders. Yeah. So one of the things I've given a lot of thought to, and I've been talking to a lot of my counterparts around, is how do we provide that and anonymize it, but still make it actionable?
Yeah.
So, just internally with our organization, we'll see an event in one of our customer organizations, and we will take that and we will anonymize it. We will provide the necessary protective and detection response capabilities to all of the others. So there is kind of a microcosm of collective defense, but getting that to the next level and not just be an intelligence bulletin like everybody gets from InfraGuard or DHS or who else, but make it actually actionable within their environments. I think if we can get there, then that'll be a significant help, partially because, you know, you can't stick your head in the sand when it's tangible and specific to your organization. And partially because most of these organizations get it, they just don't know what to do with it. So that taking that information and making it really actionable is going to be key to helping, while not, you know, requiring additional investments or additional expertise that really isn't available.
Excellent. You know, I ask this question to everybody who comes on the show, and I think I've got a good idea where you're going to fall with this one, but ransomware is a huge issue for manufacturing for a number of different reasons. When you're hit with a ransomware attack, there is that ultimate decision of whether to pay or not to pay. Where do you stand? What is your take? What's your opinion on that response?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a lawyer answer, and because it depends. Yeah, there's a general saying you don't negotiate with terrorists, but sometimes you do, right? Most organizations now within manufacturing have some sort of cyber insurance. They've got critical functions that they provide. Yeah, and I would, you know, and you can't say that one answer overall is going to be right for everybody. Or the consumers, their organizations they support. Yeah, I'll give you a tangible example. There was a crisis because of a plant being contaminated with baby formula. And this wasn't a cyber event, but this was really a safety, public health sure. concern. And the fact that you couldn't get that baby formula out, you know, people experienced significant amount of both physical and psychological trauma associated with that, that manufacturer not being able to get their goods out to the market. So would you say, you know, don't pay a $10,000 ransom if it's going to mean that babies may die, not be able to get the formula that they need? Absolutely not. I mean, as a general rule, paying ransom incentivizes more ransomware in theory, right? But you have to get left of boom on this. You have to start thinking about how do we prevent the access that's needed for them to be able to execute that type of activity. Because once they can get in, once they can release that payload, whether you pay the ransom or not, it doesn't really impact your mission at that point any differently. You may pay the ransom and not be able to unencrypt the data. So it has to be part of a risk analysis. You've got to make the best, business decision and understand where you fit in the supply chain. Before you just make a blanket statement like we will or will not pay, and you're not the only one who gets a vote at that point either. Unless you're a single owner of a privately held enterprise, the odds are that there's cyber insurer involved. There are other considerations like the impact of the board, whether or not it's public. All of those things have to come into play because now you're just trying to react and get off of the X, right? You've already started to deal with some of those consequences. So getting on the other side of that is going to take primacy over a theoretical or philosophical view on whether or not you should come out of pocket.
No, fair enough. So, Jeff, I think we've talked about the stuff that's going to keep us all up at night a little bit too much. Let's talk about some of the good guys and maybe some of the things that Conquest Cyber is up to.
You know, our mission is from the beginning has been to protect the sectors that are critical to our way of life. And we are seeing that being beyond a mission statement means that we're dealing with the type of adversaries that most organizations are not really thinking about. We think about mission and the services that those critical infrastructure sectors and government provide to that ultimately impact our way of life. Without them, we would not have the opportunity that we have. So that means that we're typically talking about things that nobody else is. You know, when you talk about ransomware, I'm thinking access, supply chain, disruption. The ability to encrypt, access, exfiltrate, potentially. Critical data that can be used to target other sectors. So what we've been really working on is trying to connect those dots between the risk that organizations are exposed to and the operations they're performing. And that means that we're taking a much more strategic view on the relationship between the different organizations within the sectors themselves, the relationships those sectors have with government, and trying to up everybody's game, to trying to help with that mobilization, so we all realize that we're all kind of on that thin digital line between order and chaos. So, you know, getting to more customers, getting to more sectors, solving more of the administrative challenges around compliance, while really not stopping there and getting past compliance as fast as possible into provable effectiveness. That's where we've been spending our time. And obviously, you know, with where we sit, we've been dealing with a lot of nation state level, you know, adversaries that are, you know, attacking our partners and customers. But that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, gives us energy. It validates that what we're doing, you know, is a continued service. And it informs a lot of how we support not just that organization, but all the other organizations on a day-to-day basis. So really, it's been a very dynamic year for us, particularly with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and you know, in response after last year of, you know, Log4j and Log4shell and the Microsoft Exchange server access. I mean, it's been yeah, it's been a very interesting time from a business standpoint. It's been a good time to be within this industry, but you know, it's been you know, a labor of love for a lot of the people in the organization. And you know, and when we deal with those types of threats, it just validates that, you know, kind of our chosen profession is not just a solid business decision, but, you know, a good moral decision for us as well.
You know, it's interesting. You bring up Log4j and you bring up some of the nation state attackers that are out there. I can appreciate the similarities, but when those two things hit your desk, they have to elicit a little bit of a different response. You know, I would think the soldier in you comes out a little bit when you're talking about nation states. Log4j is, and I'm not trying to minimize it, almost more of an administrative type of dynamic. Is there one of those that gets your juices flowing a little bit more or impacts your approach?
Yeah. So I think about this in terms of a proxy war, and what would I do if I was in the adversary's positions? Because that's really how I was trained to think. You know, growing up in the special operations community, you know, it was never a good versus evil, you know, type of mentality for us. It was always a healthy level of respect that's required to understand what motivates them to do things like, you know, strapping on a suicide vest. What is it that they are so allegiant to that, and how desperate do they have to be in order to see that as their only opportunity? And you realize that it's not crazy. It's just a different perspective and different allegiances. So when I see something like a Log4j, you know, Log4shell, Microsoft Exchange Server, things that get identified and then largely, you know, pushed out to industry and many people view it as an administrative task. I think about it from an adversary's perspective, is that provides me the perfect cover for action to exploit that. And I don't do it, you know, from the perspective of now I have an in to, you know, this organization I'm particularly targeting. I think about it as like, all right, I'm going to build a capability to identify rapidly all the low hanging fruit customers that I could potentially access. And I'd have a list of targets, and that list of targets immediately ties back to the critical infrastructure sectors and national critical functions that provide. And I would build some automation that allowed me to essentially target all of those and identify if that vulnerability was easily exploitable or in any of those networks. And I may use that as my front door. And then I'm going to go in and I'm going to build persistent access. So when I look at all of these things, you know, 0 days don't keep me up at night. It's all of those, the basic hygiene functions that, you know, make it easy, to where the most sophisticated adversaries still are using some of the simplest, approaches, oldest exploits, tools you can, easily get off the interweb. And then once they have access, then they're doing the things that get more complicated. And that's, and they're doing that to avoid detection and have a long-term capability. So, my view is you should prevent everything that you can predict so we can start adapting to everything else. Because right now, if I had to determine 5 design basis threat scenarios for every organization, that is a really easy thing to do. And of those 5, have they put in the necessary protective measures? Do they have the detection systems in place? And they have a plan for responding and recovering? In most instances, they don't have it for any of those 5 that would be like, of course, if you're in manufacturing, you should be concerned about ransomware. So I don't really draw a distinction about the exploit or the vulnerability. I think about it more from what does this enable? If I'm an adversary who wants to gain a geopolitical advantage, but wants to gain access to a critical sector, wants to gain access to information that ultimately helps them target other sectors. Because that's, you're not going to do the most complicated thing first. You can do all the easy stuff. And then you'll apply some more intellectual capital once you've found the slowest gazelle.
Well, I love your response to that, because regardless of the type of attack that you're dealing with, that initial strategy, the initial response is similar, if not identical, regardless of what it is, regardless of how many headlines it's going to get, so on and so forth. So that makes a lot of sense. Last question here, Jeff, and I'll let you go. This has been great. As we look forward in the next maybe 12 to 18 months, are there any trends that are really sticking out for you, either from a positive perspective in terms of things that we can get better at or are getting better at, or on the other side of the coin, are there things we really have to be careful of because the threat is growing or the tactic is becoming more prominent?
So the thing that gives me the greatest pause is that I think from a cyber industry perspective, we're our own worst enemy. If you go to some of these conferences, you'll see really innovative capabilities, emerging capabilities that are that have massive potential to impact our collective defense. And as soon as they get a little bit of traction, all of the marketing, makes it to where it's impossible to determine whether it's a real capability or it's just marketing jargon. It makes it hard for customers, for cybersecurity and IT leaders and staff to know what it is that they're getting and what it protects them against, how it enables them to provide better detection, response, and recovery. So, aside from the marketing jargon, I think the areas that are that I think are really positive trends is the concepts around cybersecurity mesh. And unfortunately, because it's starting to gain traction, everybody at the next conference, known cybersecurity conference here, everybody's going to be saying how they're part of the cybersecurity mesh. But really for us, it's about connecting risk and operations back to risk, and doing it in a way that is actually consumable, not just to technologists and cybersecurity professionals, but to business leaders. So they have transparency and context to make better decisions. So I think the next buzzword that actually gets me excited is cybersecurity mesh. And unfortunately, the thing that upsets me is that now everything is going to be called cybersecurity mesh, just like everything has been called, XDR and all of that. My hope is we'll see some additional consolidation and then maybe a shift in mindset now that there's some changes in the economy, that it's not just, get a bunch of VC cash, build a really light MVP that only does one thing and then get it gobbled up by a larger business. But we'll start to see some innovative companies that really have a broader impact on our collective defense and on people's mindsets and enable some greater mobilization, start to gain traction and not just be overwhelmed by some of the cybersecurity companies that have either gotten a head start or the ones that have gotten a massive amount of money based on the idea of a product that never really comes to fruition.
Real quick, give us your take on cybersecurity mesh in terms of defining it very broadly.
Yeah, so from my view, cybersecurity mesh essentially pulls all together the different domains of cyber and the types of data that are needed in order to deliver those outcomes, from risk analysis to threat intelligence to vulnerabilities to the actual operations that allow you to protect and detect and respond to them, and does it in a way that normalizes the data and ultimately enables you to connect more of those dots and get to some more predictable outcomes. So without the normalization of data and the telemetry, it's really impossible. You end up writing a thousand different APIs into your platform in order to connect a few of those dots. Or if we just get to a point where we get to a standard language, almost like, wrenches, you have standard and metric. If we could just get to an equivalent point rather than everything being a special snowflake, then I think we'll be able to get further faster. But it will ultimately result in a significant amount of consolidation in the industry, which right now I think is probably deserving of it, given how many tools exist to do really, really wonky niche things.
Thanks, Jeff. For more information on the work Conquest does, you can go to conquestcyber.com. Thanks for joining us today. And to catch up on past episodes, you can go to manufacturing.net, IEN.com, or MBTMag.com. You can also check Security Breach out wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple, Amazon, and Overcast. And if you have a cybersecurity story that you'd like us to explore here on Security Breach, you can reach me at jeff@IEN.com. For Jeff Engel, I'm Jeff Ranke, and this is Security Breach.